Another dial painter who wasn't tested was Della Harveston, who had been part of the original clique with Catherine, Charlotte and Mary Vicini, Ella Cruz and Innes Corcoran. She had died the previous year of tuberculosis. Red-haired Peg Looney, however, was summoned by Mr. Reed to his home for a test. Yet when her colleagues asked her how she'd got on, she had to tell them she hadn't a clue. In Orange, the medical exam results had been secretly shared with the company behind the women's backs. In Ottawa, they went straight to the corporation and cut out the middlewoman entirely. Neither Peg nor any of her tested co-workers were told the results. Peg settled back at her desk in the studio without worry, however, picking up her brush and licking her lips in preparation for painting. She wasn't at all concerned. The company, she was sure, would tell her if anything was wrong. All the girls in Ottawa still lip-pointed, little knowing that 800 miles away, the practice had been banned. Yet behind the scenes, at the head office of Radium Dial, its executives, mindful of the New Jersey lawsuit, now started putting some thought into finding an alternative method of applying the paint, just in case. Chamoy was trialled, but found too absorbent. Rubber sponges were employed, but they didn't work right. Radium Dial's vice president, Rufus Fordyce, admitted, however, that their endeavours were somewhat half-hearted. No strenuous effort, he later acknowledged, has been made to find and provide any suitable manner to eliminate the procedure. The company eventually tasked Mr. Reed with the job of finding an alternative method. Soon he would start tinkering with the idea of a glass pen, such as was employed by Swiss-style painters, and began to work up various designs. In the meantime, the Ottawa girls kept on. Lip. Dip. Paint. Their fun times kept right on, too. These days, many of them had a man on their arm as the young women started courting. Back in high school, Peg Looney's favourite song had been the independent-minded "I Ain't Nobody's Darling," but now she had changed her tune. She was stepping out with a bright young man called Chuck. Anyone with half a brain could see that any one of these days he was going to propose. Chuck was his nickname. His full title was the much more distinguished-sounding Charles Hackensmith. He was a gorgeous, well-muscled, broad-shouldered and tall young man with curling fair hair. His high school yearbook said the phrase that defined him was, "And the cold marble athlete leapt to life." Yet to be the beau of clever Peg Looney, you couldn't be all brawn and no brain, and Chuck was as smart as could be. He made the senior honour roll at high school and was a college guy. "He was big educated," said Peg's sister Jean. "He was everything. He was just elegant, really. Awful good." He grew up living just around the block from Peg and her large family, and although he was now away at college, he came home on weekends, and that was when the young couple really let their hair down. Chuck had a shack at his house where he would throw parties and play records on his beat-up old gramophone. As spectators clapped along and drank illicit home-brewed root beer, the dancing would begin. Whenever Chuck hugged Peg to him, he left not an inch between them. Two bodies pressed close as they danced to the latest jazz tunes. Chuck was flirtatious. This girl, he knew, was something special. Everybody would go down the shack. Marie Becker would have a hoot there. She would zip about between friends if a party was taking place, encouraging everyone to attend. Marie was courting Patrick Rossiter, a labourer who had a large nose and big features, whom she'd met at the National Guard Armoury while skating. "He was a devil," said his family. "He used to like to have fun." Catherine Wolfe, too, would attend as a good friend of Peg. She was single at that time. And all the Loonies would be there as well. "The whole family!" exclaimed Jean. And there were 10 of us.